Accession number 29163, Reel 2.
John Charrow, Reel 2. So your new market and your first operation was departed from there.
Yes, that was in December 41 with this new skipper, Sergeant Wild. And I have to say that with this sergeant, we were not really very successful with our trips. Things always seemed to be going wrong. As I see from the first one, that we had to return after 1 hour 25 because of some fault with the aircraft. And then the next one, we had to return again because there was more trouble with the aircraft. And eventually on the third one, we did deliver someone successfully in France. So that was after the fourth trip. And then the same thing happened. Out of seven trips that we did with Sergeant Wild, only two were successfully delivered. In other words, we came back. And so after that, he was, this Wing Commander Farley, who was in charge at that time, he moved with us to Thamesford. He came up with Sergeant Wild, and after that trip, Sergeant Wild was posted away as an instructor in RAF Kinloss, which was again way up near Lossiemouth on the Moray Firth, right in the north of Scotland. And so he was there doing instructing. And there was I without a crew again, second time without a crew. And I was then hanging about Thamesford. I did various trips where someone, the navigator, was ill or something, or they wanted a second pilot to do map reading or something like that, and to help. And that's what I did for one or two trips. And then eventually there was a flight sergeant, Freeland, who was posted to the squadron. And he was a very experienced chap. And we did, as a crew, we did nine trips with him in the months of May, I think it was May, yes, nine trips, and seven of those were successful, which at that time was a very high rate, because there were all sorts of things that can go wrong, both on our side, the flying side, and of course the people over there waiting to receive were the containers or bodies, whichever it was. I mean, we would start off, I mean, the Met officer at the briefings was always a big laugh as soon as someone said, and now the Met officer will talk about the weather, the whole crew room would go, ha ha ha, you see. And they did their best. Obviously they didn't have the equipment that we've got nowadays, but you get things wrong. The wind would be wrong and the weather wouldn't be seen, and you can't drop unless you have found the markers, otherwise it just goes anywhere, so you had to turn around.
Could you you mentioned the briefings there. Could you tell me a little bit about perhaps if there is such a thing as a typical day, if you're going on operations, if there'll be a briefing and then dinner
and
so on.
Well, yes, you would be put on a board saying that your crew was operating that night. And so you would then get yourself ready. The captain would call you together, the skipper would call you together and say, right, we're doing an NFT, night flying test, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, whatever. And you would go up and do an hour around the aerodrome, circling, testing everything. The gunners would test their guns, and then you would land and have your meal, and then assemble for about an hour, hour and a half before takeoff in the crew room, and then get taken out to your aircraft. It's very different from bomber command, because if a bomber squadron was going out, there'd be 12 aircraft probably all lined up. They had to go one after the other together and probably fly in some sort of formation to begin with, whereas we didn't. I mean, we were single aircraft going off different times, different parts of the country. Some might be going to Belgium, some to France, some might be going into Norway. So it was a much more individual sort of briefing and takeoff than the normal squadron.
So you wouldn't have, for example, you mentioned the Met officer there, but you wouldn't perhaps have a gunnery leader would come and give a talk?
No, you wouldn't have a gunnery leader. You would have a chap who would say, we have heard that they have reinforced guns at such and such a town. Well, that didn't interest us. We didn't want to go over towns and be found. We wanted to sneak up, as it were, on to where we knew we were going to drop and where we knew someone was waiting. But having said that, there were also things called blind drops. Now, this was for a body only, or maybe two bodies. And if they were starting up a new cell, then you would drop two people, one with the, well, he was called the pianist, who was ready to give the signals, and then another leader who was being sent to start a new group of people within that area, and that would be a blind drop. But it would have been looked at by somebody else and said, well, this is a suitable field, it's not near a main road, there's a farmer who we think is friendly, and he would probably be able to welcome you in his field. And that was their blind drop. So there were no lights from us to look for there.
How much contact did you have with the Joes, as you mentioned before?
Well, the crew, not so much. The skipper would probably meet them as they came up to the aircraft. But we wouldn't. We would already be in our places. They were delivered by young women, normally, fannies, or WAF officers, and they would have already received all their briefing. And, of course, one of the things that the skippers always told us was, and they've got their cyanide pill with them. And I used to think it horrible, but it was a thing that they had to carry, and that was it. They were all issued with a cyanide pill, and I expect many of them used it.
Did you see them?
Oh, yes, yes. A couple, I remember so clearly. Well, to us, what was I then, 19, 20, they must have been at least 35 or 40, you know. And these two came up to the aircraft. I do remember seeing them board because they had round them, their waist, a whole load of hand grenades and stuck in their waists. And so eventually we dropped them. They went quite happily. And we said to the skipper afterwards, this was his flight sergeant Freeland, said to them, do you know what they were doing? He said, yes, there were two Belgian people, I was told. They were being dropped in France because Belgium did not have the sort of organisation that the French had for their resistance. And they were being received by French resistance, and then they were going to cross the border into Belgium and blow up a few railway lines. And I thought, this is an extraordinary story. Presumably it's right, I don't know. But it was a good story.
Did you also see any of the staff who delivered them? You know, did they arrive in trucks or?
No, they came in one of the private cars, you know, an army vehicle, straight from what's called Gibraltar Farm. We had an area on Rive Thames called Gibraltar Farm, where all the Joes were taken to and debriefed and briefed and making sure that they had nothing on them that would tell where they came from. And I think they were very closely scrutinised as to what they had in their pockets and all this sort of thing before they went off. But and then they usually came back at Tangier, which was our other station, other airfield along the coast in Sussex, where the Lysanders went from for pickups.
To talk again about, for example, a typical op.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about the importance of the moon in these?
Yeah, well, we only operated about 14 to 16 nights in a month. So the moon was really essential, particularly for me, because, I mean, you had no other lights in Europe at all. But if there was a moon, you could pick up the rivers, and particularly the lakes and the forests. And we did a lot of operations down on the Loire. And I got to know the route down there, and I could also got to know two forests that were very close to the river. And so once you saw the river, if I wasn't very sure where I was, then we would just go up the river a bit, find the forest I wanted, and then set off from there, map reading. I mean, this business that I learned on navigation school, dead reckoning, keeping a log of every twist and turn, was hopeless on this job. You really just had to watch the ground. I mean, we would make a route out, which avoided all the big cities. But on the other hand, you had to know where you were all the time. Well, we were flying, 350, 400 feet, that's all, having climbed up to 6,000 across the coast in order to avoid the flak. We would then drop down to a very low. And of course, it's very difficult for the pilot going at a lower height because, of course, everything's going past so quickly. But it was the only way to do it, really, well, I found, anyway.
Could other members of the crew help in any way?
Oh, yes, oh, very much so. But the rear gunner, particular. And in both, when it was Flight Sergeant Freeland, but particularly when I had Skipper Squadron Leader Griffiths, the rear gunners were very good, and they were very good picking up a change in wind for me, because it was essential to keep some sort of plot.
Mm-hmm. Again, just again a sort of typical drop, if there was such a thing. What were the procedures if you were closing in on a dropping zone?
Yeah, well, you're closing in. You've got to, first of all, there would be no lights there. They would wait till they heard the aircraft noise. So if you thought you were pretty near, you would do perhaps a circle, or maybe two circles, at about 500 feet. And then the first light would come on, and it would flash a recognition signal that we knew of, and they would know of the return that our wireless operator would send from a handheld lamp. And then we, having established that, they would then get their other torch men, as they called them, lined up, and then one going across to tell us the wind direction. So we had to go upwind. And when they were all set, then we would come down, if it was containers, to about 250 feet. And then it was my responsibility to try and get the containers on the lights so that they could quickly deal with them, because they had problems. We had a talk once, came to the squadron, one of the chaps who was on the ground. He was an Englishman, but he was running a big group in France, and he came to explain, because we would complain, oh, they weren't there, you know. And then he came over, and there was all sorts of things. They had to find a field that was sufficient distance from a road or something like that. And then if they felt that the daylight was going to come too soon, they would have to spend daylight hours digging trenches to hide the containers in as soon as we dropped them, because they knew it was going to be difficult to pick them up when it got light. And they would have to come back on the next night probably to do that. And if they'd failed to do that, or if a German patrol had come past when they were hoping to do it, then of course they would have to cancel, they wouldn't be there. But they wouldn't be able to tell us in time. I mean, they got a message at 6 o'clock on the BBC, a coded message, which they knew was that we were coming that night. But there was no way of cancelling that once the thing had been set into motion. So this sort of thing, you know, we were told, and then we realised that, yeah, they had big problems. And our big problem was the weather.
Once the drop had been made. Were personnel dropped? Were personnel dropped at a different height?
Height, yes. You drop them at 500 to 600 feet, so you know, more time, of course, for the parachute to open.
Did the aircraft have to be
very steady? Yes, this was the whole thing, and this was. I was by this time I was in the nose of the aircraft all the time, and just telling him, you know, left, right, steady, steady, and the skipper would be calling out the height so that I knew that he was at the right height, because I had no idea of that where I was. And then when it was all set, as I say, it was a question of red button first and then the green, and the green went off you go.
And then once that had, once the drop had been made, heading home.
Yes. Well, once the drop was made, I forgot to say this, the skippers used to slow the aircraft down by putting wheels down and maybe some flat, so that you were going much slower but not stalling, hopefully, because that would be it. And then as soon as I'd said, you know, they're all gone, then up with the flaps and up with the wheels. And then we would just turn around and make our way home as quickly as we could, but still keeping low. Sometimes we had leaflets to drop, which was a sort of diversion, and sometimes we had the pigeons. Now, that was great fun.
Could you explain both of those, actually, the leaflets?
Yeah, the leaflets.
How that would be done.
Well, we had a chute where you could use as a toilet, if necessary. I've never known anybody do it, but it was a little chute. We had these bundles of leaflets. It was it was usually the rear gunner's job, or the wireless operators, and they would tear the string off them and push them down this, and then they would float away down below. But the pigeons, so we were much more careful about those. They had their own little parachute. They were in a little cage made of cardboard, and they had food in there and some water. And we used to try and find a nice quiet spot for these so that they would be all right. And they would drop, we would drop them and watch them go down, you see. And sometimes the quite useful information used to come back, I gather. I mean, we didn't see that, of course, because there would be a little pencil in this cage, if you like, and a piece of rice paper. And they were supposed to get hold of these pigeons, you see, and write a message and put it around their waist, around their legs, and send them back. But it did work. They said that you got some interesting information. In fact, in one of the books, I can't remember which it is, the chap's talking about SOE, he says that quite often they would find that someone in the village had said that Monsieur so-and-so was a traitor and could he be dealt with? So, whether that ever happened, I mean, I can quite believe it would, knowing some of these resistance people, yes.
And I suppose the Germans would have occasionally...
Oh, well, they picked them up, yes, and I think they got funny notes back, yes.
Yeah, we talked about the pigeons and the drops and supplies and personnel. There was another aspect of navigation I wanted to ask you about, was Rebecca and Eureka.
Yes, well, that is only just starting when I finished. I never used Eureka, I used Rebecca. Rebecca was the one where it was a very short distance, really. I forget how much it was, not more than about 15 miles, I think. And that was when you knew you were near the drop, but you couldn't actually see it. And then we used to use that. But I think that became much more sophisticated after I'd finished my tour. And I didn't really come into the use of that very much at all.
Could you describe, though, how Rebecca worked, what it was? It's a little...
It was just something attached to the aircraft, which actually the skipper used always. I didn't use it. I never actually saw what was on the ground. I don't know what they had there. But it was something that was proved to be useful, as I say, after I'd left. I don't really know much about that, no.
Just, again, to talk a bit about, not necessarily operations, but more perhaps about the squadron itself mm-hmm. and the setup at Thamesford. So yes. you were, I believe, was it renamed 138 Squadron
yes.
when you went to
yes,
Thamesford?
Yes.
But there was also 161.
161, but the other ones had the Lysanders and the Oxfords that did the pickups. We were always the, well, as I say, Whitley's first and then the Halifaxes we had. We were always doing the dropping, and 161 were doing the pickups.
Did you mix?
Yes. We have used the same mess, yes. Oh, yes, the two squadrons used the same mess, the sergeant's mess and the officer's mess. I was in the sergeant's mess then at that time, most of it.
What was Thamesford like? Was it a large airfield then, or was it?
Pretty large, yes. Oh, yes. It was all made from a farm, of course. The runways were very good. The approach for the pilots was not so good because there was a hill just on the approach to the main runway, which meant that they had to be very careful coming in. But it was a well-placed wing because it was otherwise it was very handy for getting to everywhere we wanted to go, and not too far, you know, wasting fuel before you could get to where you wanted to be.
And where were you all? You mentioned the messing there, but also billeting as well.
Oh, yes. Well, when I first went there, they hadn't finished the field, and so a lot of us were billeted out. And I was billeted with this Mr. and Mrs. Gray in a very large house in Sandy, and they looked after me very well. I had a really great time there. And then we had a Red Lion pub, where that was our meeting place. Well, I haven't said that we had Czech crews and Polish crews with us there, and they were tremendous people. They really were.
I'll ask you about them in a minute, actually, the sort of things they did. But you mentioned Mr. and Mrs. Gray. Did they have any idea what you were doing?
No. They never mentioned it anyway. All they knew was that there was an RAF station there. I think it was a well-kept secret. From what I read after the war, I think it was a fairly well-kept secret from the villagers.
I was going to ask you about the locals, whether they had any idea.
No, I don't think so, no.
Was security, security on every RAF airfield would have been tight anyway.
Yeah.
But also, the agents would have been billeted nearby, and you mentioned...
Well, they were brought from London to this Trafalgar Farm, presumably on the day of the night that they were going to be dropped. I can't imagine there was a combination. It wasn't all that big for them to stay very long. So, yes, they were brought there in army saloon cars.
And the other crews as well. Were you aware of, you must have been aware of casualties, of crews not coming back?
Yes.
What sort of proportion was this? Was it a common occurrence?
Well, it was fairly high. they used to say you were lucky to get past your 20 operations, which I suppose is fair comment when we were trying to do 30. But quite a few people did. I was particularly lucky, I suppose. I went on and did 37. But you didn't think so much about that. One of my grandsons asked me this some time ago, and I said, no, you don't think of that. You might think that so-and-so won't come back, but you will. And that, I think, was the way most crews thought about it. Bomber Command, I think, the losses were much heavier.
Were you aware at the time that the Bomber Command casualties were so high?
No, not at the time, no. When they did try and get us, they started, you remember there was a 1,000 bomber raid that Bomber Harris was very keen to do, one on Berlin and one on Cologne, and he asked Group Captain Fielden, who at the time was, well, what was his official thing? Master of the King's Flight. You know, there was a flight that the RAF ran for his Majesty at that time. And he was a real character, and he was a groupie, and this was what was his that time, Bomber Harris. Anyway, one of the high ranking egg on his cap people, and old Fielding just said, "No, you're not having my crews. They are doing a valuable job, and if you're going to insist," he said, "I shall just have a word with Mr. Churchill." And we didn't go, and we didn't want to go, because there were heavy casualties on those raids. So Fielden was very good to us. I think he carried some weight, because it was Churchill, wasn't it, who started this, you know, who set Europe ablaze, and this is how really SOE started.
And the size of the operation of the special duty, the work of the special duty squad was expanding.
It grew and grew, yes. I mean, I didn't realise after I left how much it did grow. I mean, the United States of America got in with it, of course, towards the end, where they were dropping huge numbers of containers and arms for the Mackey. And our squadron was increased, I gather, considerably, and other squadrons were brought in as it got near to D-Day.